Hi, folks. My name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual, hormonal, and genitourinary health. And I have my former fellowship director here with me today, Dr. Ryan Terlecky.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I'm still at Wake Forest Atrium Health now, and I'm the vice chair of urology and, similar to you, specialist in reconstructive urology.
Awesome. So, you go to a lot of these meetings, both in the United States and internationally, and a lot of the meetings are focused on reconstruction. And you went to the GERS meeting yesterday. So talk me through what some of the presentations we're talking about
Okay.
and where you perceive the future of presentations when it comes to GERS is going.
Yeah, I think that, Amy, I think that's a great question. I think reconstruction means different things to different people, and it's kind of a broad umbrella term. And I think this meeting has highlighted some data, and they're trying to gauge what's the future. Is it going to be incorporate all things, transgender care related? Is it going to be what Sean Elliott described yesterday at the GERS session as congenitalism or urocongenitalism? I know Dr. Wood is heavily involved in that as well. But I think that it's going to be program specific. The meeting yesterday largely consisted of surgical technique videos. And having been now in the sphere of urology for about 20 years, I've seen this kind of shift in how people digest learning. Right. So in the past, it was mostly, textbook based. You'd crack open Hinman's, you'd go to Netter and so forth. And now it's a heavy reliance on video education. I don't know that that's wrong per se, but it's definitely different. And I think that educators need to be aware of that. The other thing that's kind of come up, and I think this was a focus at the SAU meeting, I know Susan McDonald had talked about this a little bit, is the approach to surgical care changing among recent graduates. I think that we're looking at a trend away from kind of more stressful cases, right? Cases that require a higher level of intensity, let's say. And so, that might be good and bad, right? You want to be able to treat, the population with what they need, but you want providers to be able to stay in the game. And not, burn out, right? So it'll be interesting to see moving forward what that means for us as a specialty and as a subspecialty.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that a lot of the presentations were now video. I don't remember at any point in my training learning how do you set up the OR to do good videos that can be presented at meetings. I remember when I was your fellow, we tried so many different things. I think you were wearing a GoPro, then
Yeah.
we had some other things set up. Should that be part of our training now, is understanding what is the infrastructure required in an operating room?
Yeah. I think you might be onto something there. I know that, our process has evolved to some degree, and we tried that VTOM camera that you'd mount to the bed. Some people still use that for surgical videos. Now I use an InLight HD camera, which actually works really well. And so,
You had one on your headlamp, and then I had to do the editing, and I was like, I'm nauseous.
Yeah, motion stabilization is a big deal. There's an industry partner here this year that I spoke with because they have a new system, and it involves a headlight camera, almost like a see-through, similar to what some of the smart glasses have been, but also a room camera to give you an additional point of view, right? And it routes through the web. There was a lot at this meeting, I think, geared perhaps more towards the cancer surgeries about telesurgery. Right. So I think that it's going to become more commonly integrated to training programs, certainly training programs that are considered centers of excellence. I mean, that terminology gets thrown around sometimes and it needs to be reined in. But if you have somebody who's recognized for a high level proficiency and you want to take it across the globe in the interest of serving as many people as possible, I think that the technology needs to be incorporated. Now, whether or not it needs to be done by the surgical providers, or whether departments and programs need to have separate AV outfits that can just handle it for us, right? I think newer OR construction is being more mindful of that, to have the wiring there, the potential there, because it's a nice bit of promotion for a center, right? To say, look at what we offer and people want to look at a video that looks clean, that looks polished, that keys in on the certain areas. And to your part, when you're talking about voiceover editing, editing is key, right? Because people don't want to watch a video that's too long. I mean, if you and I have to do modules for our jobs and there's a speed button that you can make it, you know, 2x speed to be done more quickly, you're like, yeah, I can hear everything just fine. Let's speed it up, right? So, yeah. But yeah, I think moving forward, you're going to see more and more video documentation. And of course, an attention to detail on privacy for patients and respect for, you know, the rules and regulations. Yeah.
Well, it's just interesting because as we've seen the digital platforms evolve for just social media content, right?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of room to grow in terms of like the evolution for being able to look at a video and it has all the timestamps on it. So you can look at the exact part that you want to see and may just skip through the prep part of it.
Yeah. Right?
So I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. I think when you see the thumbnails right on like a YouTube video and you can see how you can jump to key portions of an operation, I mean, you're above the mean, right? You're, you know, somebody who's a high performer as it relates to reaching out to other people through digital platforms. I mean, you're essentially an influencer in urology because you've embraced that, right? And you know how to communicate well with people. Not everybody has that skill. You know, I trained at a time where I didn't necessarily have to be as present digitally. I think that that's a luxury that I have at this point in my career because sometimes, you know, it can be time intensive and it can take you away from certain things. But I recognize where people are coming out into practice now, it's the reality. And so you have to be able to engage the digital world. And so, to your point. So, I mean, I've had a presence on YouTube to a small degree where I put some surgical videos. Initially, they were just to teach residents if I was going to teach a course. And I put it on there so they'd have easy access rather than a big file they had to download to their email. And then because I didn't make it private, somebody taps onto it and then, you know, however the algorithms work. And then lo and behold, like one surgical video has over 2 million views.
Wow.
So, you know, that's powerful. It's good for patients. It's probably good for making people aware of the services you offer. And, you know, if you're starting out in practice. So, but I think that, yeah, your point is well taken, making it more customizable, right? Interactive. I think all those things are pretty great.
And you do a lot of work going to other countries. So where do you feel like this innovation and technology might help you in your international work?
Yeah, I think, and you've been involved with me in the past, you know, global outreach, and that's really a passion project of mine. I mean, Dr. Caleb Covell, you know, who you've worked with, I've worked with, we run a nonprofit now called SPUR, or Society for Practical Urological Reconstruction, because it needs to be practical. If you want to go and you want to deliver skills, right? I mean, you don't want it to be surgical tourism where you're just going to, you know, treat a few people and the skill set doesn't translate to the population. So you're kind of torn between, do you take the most difficult cases that might not be replicated after you leave, or you take the simpler ones that are going to allow them to embrace what it takes and to treat more people. I think the latter is probably more effective. Now, even in remote areas of the world, a lot of these places will have internet access. Yeah. And so having that content there, making sure it is, again, digestible according to the culture, to the language, right? And doing so in a way that people can pick up on what you're saying. So you don't want to speak in such a manner that people can't grasp the concepts, right? And I know when you and I had participated in some of these projects before, we had looked at, for example, our Spanish-speaking patients. Mm-hmm. How do we deliver content to them?
Yes, it would be nice to have something that would translate my voiceover, but I had to do that manually.
You did, right? But now, I mean, they have these things. I mean, I have AirPods in my pocket, but like Time Kettle AirPods, you put them in.
Yes, and you're my mala.
No, adecuamente, as Dr. Covell would say. And so... But, you know, there are all these apps now, and I don't need to, you know, promote any which one, but, you know, you can put your phone out and have a conversation. But what you'll see is that even when there are sessions where you would assume that everybody speaks the dominant language, and a lot of times it's English, right? There's still a disconnect for a lot of people. And the platforms where you have somebody in a box translating and the headsets and everything else, it's
challenging.
And it's costly. I mean, those services are quite costly.
Yeah.
And so Trying to communicate with people on their terms should be a goal. So, yeah.
So you seem to always have a pulse on what's coming up next. So if we think about the world of, you know, genitourinary reconstruction, like what would you like to see at a future meeting?
I would like to see essentially an approach that embraces what providers are doing outside of university-affiliated institutions. I don't like to call it academic versus non-academic because you're almost implying that people who are on community practices are not academically oriented. I think I'm not huge on PC language police, but, you know, I think that's something we need to dial back. And so I think that office-based management of conditions is so practical. It's very interesting to people. Patients don't want to go and sign up for a full day experience waiting in, you know, the hospital and going through the whole, you know, conundrum. So as we have new industry partners, new technologies coming down the pike, I mean, you know, you look at what they're offering now for overactive bladder. You could put a coin-shaped implant in 20 minutes, you know, and then, you know, ASC, surgical center, you know, hospital, OR, outpatient, right? These types of things. So, you know, I think we have to be careful about super subspecialization as well, right? Because general urology needs are out there and the population just keeps aging and growing and so forth. And there's less and less of us available. So you could say, yeah, I'm a oncologist or I'm a reconstructive urologist. But if the demand,
fancy.
It does, right? You're right.
I love saying at the end of my intro and a, you know, reconstructive specialist.
Right. So, you know, while you can be in the pocket for, you know, the overwhelming majority of what you treat, I think starting to embrace other things as well without it seeming like it's an attack on your expertise, right? So if you're saying, well, you know, urinary health, urinary symptoms, and if this is a better way to manage it, and you look for the opportunities to embrace all relevant technologies that are going to help your patients, I think that's something that's very attractive for people to attend meetings. The people that tend to go to a lot of these smaller meetings, which it is a more intimate setting for fostering better discussion, tend to be people in the community practices.
Yes.
I think, you know, because there's not a need really to go out, hunt down CME if you're already affiliated with a, you know, an academic or university affiliated program, right? Because you're getting those almost every week, right? But other people have the budgets for CME set aside. They want to go knock it out, a lot of them in a trip, get some intense education, but they want it to be relevant and practical for their day-to-day operations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting because as trainees, we don't want to be in clinic. We want to be in the operating room with a scalpel in our hands, you know? And then when I was doing your fellowship, we did clinic 3 days a week. And I was like, I don't know if I can handle this, you know? And then I realized, oh my God, this is where medicine and surgery actually happens, is in the clinic. And now in my current practice in Miami, pretty much my entire practice is a clinic-based practice, and I freaking love it.
Yeah.
The level of stress is down here. Patients are they tend to be pretty surgery averse. Like, obviously, I still love doing surgery, but, you know, oftentimes as we go through, like, the GERS, you know, fellowship, and once we're out in practice, we do some of the most maximally invasive surgery, and so we still have to embrace the beauty of the in-office procedures.
Yeah, not only the in-office procedures, but I would say the in-office dynamic, the relationship with the patient, right? And so, again, I highlighted this earlier, but, you know, among your strengths, you know, communication skills, engaging people, reading the body language, knowing how to adjust your language, right, to come to where they want to be in terms of terminology, right? And getting them to buy in on things that are valuable to their health, right? And so if you're trying to tell somebody why this would be beneficial in the long term, right, you have to, you know, say, well, what is it you want? What are your goals? So, yeah, the clinic side of things doesn't seem as sexy to people in training because they want to get surgical training. And truth be told, it seems like they're pushing for even less hours in training now. And we've already dialed it back a good amount. And we're almost having to teach more things, right, which dilutes our ability to focus on certain silos. So you got to get that surgical training in. It is important, but it is also important to recognize how to connect with people. You know, I would say that an ability that you had that I would like to see encouraged more so among other people is the ability to lean in on things that you find stressful. Like you manage how stress level comes down. But if there's a subject matter, let's say it's the male patient with chronic genital pain, right? Sometimes that just seems like such a tough topic to manage or a difficult patient population that providers just want to avoid it. But it's kind of like what I teach my kids. If there's a subject in school that you find more stressful, more challenging, lean in on that one, master that one, and then your whole life gets better, right? So, so we would do that. So if it was a genital pain thing, you've got a one pager that the patient reads when they show up for a new patient visit, the inventory that you've designed that gets you all the information you need for decision making, and then they can see, this is where we'll walk through and we'll try to rule out anything that we can manage. But if we rule out all surgical pathology, or if it looks medical, we'll try to get you where you need to be, rather than saying, well, you come to my office, go to pain management, right? So find out what's difficult, right? And make it so it's not. And if you come up with systems, it's all plug and play, and you can focus on the individual sitting across.
You know, there was something that you said to me during fellowship, and you said, never be afraid to walk into a patient's room. You have the knowledge you need to treat that patient.
Yeah.
That changed my mindset completely. And I used to think about it very often. Now it changed my mindset. So I don't even have to think about that topic, right?
Yeah.
So that was like a key thing that you verbalized. So simple, such a simple phrase.
Yeah.
And then there was another, there was something else that Dr. Alan Wien, who I trained with at University of Pennsylvania, said to me, and he said, find something that no one else wants to treat and do some research in that, and then you will be able to build your career, right?
Yeah.
And so then, like, you know, during my practice at Iowa, I always think about all the things that everyone hates to treat, and I was like, I'm going to figure that out.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that's it. Trailblazing, I don't know the adjective to put on it or the name to put to it, but I think that that approach is so necessary, right? We need to look for the opportunities to advance the field. And so I think that you've carved out a niche of wellness, right, within urology, whereas before it wasn't in our hands, right? We had paramedical people, you know, offering it, and then perhaps maybe some primary care. But to bring it under the umbrella of somebody who's at such a high level of training in men's health, for example, right? And say, well, what does wellness look like? Because you and I know, especially if you treat sexual health, you'll get people who will come to you that have never seen a primary care provider. And the answer that they might give was, I'm only going to the doctor if I'm dying. Well, you're here for erectile dysfunction. Yeah, that's like die, right? It's so, but those opportunities, if you see someone like that, you care about who they are as like the whole complete individual, it gives you a powerful platform to say, hey, look, I know that this is why you're here and I'm going to do cover that. But at the same time, you haven't checked your cholesterol. You're now in your 50s. You've never had a colonoscopy. Your blood pressure, based on what we just checked here in the office, is high. Yeah, it might be, you know, situational, but we don't know that. So that's wonderful.
I want to come full circle here very briefly, because we started off this conversation talking about, well, the way that we define genitourinary reconstruction is highly variable. So does wellness, does lifestyle modification, does helping someone lose weight, let's say in our buried penis, you know, patient population.
Yeah.
So does that play a role in GERS, or might it?
I think it should. I think that if you think about cost of care, right? If you think about inconvenience to the patient and patient fatigue, right? If you're relying on too many other places to be involved, I understand the concepts of multidisciplinary care, but one of the things that doesn't get discussed a lot is patient fatigue. So if you're driving from Dr. A on one day, Dr. B on another day, you know, clinic C for your weight loss on another day.
3 months and then 6 months later.
Right. Yeah. You get the referrals, you make the appointments, everything's backed up. If you're still working and taking time off, you know, gas prices being what they are, depending on where you live and where you have to get to. Now, telehealth has helped, but, you know, we're always wondering, are we in jeopardy of losing the coverage for that and having that go away, right? So, again, multidisciplinary I get, but, you know, you think about why people love online shopping, why they love big box stores, one-stop shopping, right? It's convenience and it's about their time. time is your most valuable resource. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're not getting any more of it. And if you think like that along those lines and how to help your patients in a more global sense, I agree with you. I think that whether you call it reconstruction or whether we rebrand, right, to just restorative urology, right, then you got to think, well, what's the package of care that I need to deliver to get you to cross the finish line? And how much of that package can I give you here rather than making you go a la carte to all these other places? No.
Well, stay tuned. Maybe we'll figure that out.
Hey, there you go.
Well, thank you, Dr. Terlecki, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We'll see you on the next episode.